Erev Tov, everybody. It's time to get started to welcome back Dr. Mark, part 44, but part one of the sort of our spring semester. And we look forward, we're getting to the tail end of his book, and we're looking forward to welcome back after a couple week hiatus. We hope everybody is doing well, and Bakasha.
Dr. Yes, Shapiro, and thank you. I'm good to be here. I'll just say that although people don't realize this, maybe when they write it one day, that Torah in Motion and Rabbi Kelman is really the originator of this format. Now everyone does it. But when it first began, no one was doing it. And the Torah in Motion was really the originator in the Jewish world for Shiurim of this interactive sort of thing. So I put that on the record there. Unfortunately, in those days, you didn't put it on YouTube, you didn't do it, but they're all taped, and you can listen to it on the brand new website. It's very easy to access. So I encourage all that, everyone, to do that. We're part 44, and we're coming close to the end. In fact, I realized, though, before we finish, when we finish with the book, we should have one class on the letters not included, because there's a couple of very interesting ones, and I'll explain to you why they weren't included and who they are from. And wait till you see one of them who is from. I think it'll blow you away. And I think you'll also understand why I chose not to include it. Before we start, I said this is only for the Americans, not for the Canadians. But, you know, we're getting our vaccines and everything. So as far as I'm concerned, anyone want to have in-person talks? I'm available, probably including Shavuos also. So here you go. At least in Florida and Texas, that's for sure. I don't know if David Eisen is with us. Just a couple of things. I've been waiting since it's 3 weeks. I want to follow up on some things in the last class and then begin. But since it's Yom HaTzmaut soon, and my son was emailing me questions about what they do in Yom HaTzmaut, so I looked in the book, the RCA Siddur, the new one, which, unlike the old one, has a lot to do with Yom HaTzmaut. And I'm just wondering, you know, it has a Maariv service here. Is there anyone in America, maybe in Canada, the B'nai Akiva, I've never been to an American show. I don't even know if I've been to an Israeli show where they do the special Maariv for Yom HaTzmaut. And then Shacharis, where you do Pesukah Dezimra of Yom Tov. This might be a B'nai Akiva thing.
You're dabbling in the wrong shuls.
No. In New Jersey, I never even heard B'nai Akiva growing up. There might be B'nai Akiva, but I'm just wondering for the Americans. But you're saying Canada, they do this.
Obviously in the Mizrahi, we're a strong Mizrahi presence in the schools here. Yeah, they have a big thing. They get 50, I mean, not now, but they'll get 1,500 people. You know, they do
special
like
a Maariv with
special Maariv, Kabbalat Shah, little
Kabbalat Shabbos. Okay.
Yes. Musical instruments. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We thought that we were a Zionist shows in America, but I've never.
It's different. I'm not
special Haftorah. Whoever heard of a Haftorah?
The Rav went crazy. We do it in Shatter. They all do the Haftorah. Okay.
You know, the Rav went crazy when they did the Haftorah.
Yes. The Rav didn't like it. No. He didn't like a lot of things. On those issues.
Okay. Right. Just from the last classes, I mentioned I didn't actually explain it. So one of you asked me, but it's on Wikipedia. I was talking about the rabbis in Scranton, and I mentioned one of them is a signer of the Israel Declaration of Independence, Wolf Gold, Zev Gold. So someone asked, well, why? Well, you can read it here. He when he goes to Israel, he's a big macher in the Mizrahi. He was in the Jewish Agency. He was, it says the vice president of the Provisional State Council. Here it says it, actually, Machon Gold. Machon Gold was named after him. We all know Machon Gold, at least I shouldn't say all of us. Anyone over 30, I'm sure, knows Machon Gold. It was around, it was like the female counterpart for BMT. Machon Gold was named after Rabbi Zev Gold. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of his famous hespedim, is for Rav Zev Gold. What else do I want to tell you? Naftali would like this very much. We spoke about Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And I found, just by accident, a whole discussion online about the German, how they pronounced his name. And let me show you something here. So if you go on the Otzer HaChachma forum, they speak about this and how it's strange because his father's Rafal and how he becomes Rafal. In fact, at his tombstone, it says Shimon Ben Rafael, but his wife's tombstone, which is right next to him, he's called Shamshon Rafal. And they included here, this is all they included, a copy of a letter we don't know what it's in, what language it's in, and but it's signed, it's in Judeo-German, and he says it's to his grandson, your grandfather, Großvater, and then you see it written, Shamshon. But I really would like to, this doesn't really prove the case. We know how he pronounced his name from the tradition in the family, but I don't know if this is a German letter. I've never heard of Hirsch writing a letter in German and Hebrew characters. It might be a Hebrew letter where he just signed it in German. So what you'd want to see is a Hebrew letter where he signs it Shamshon, because I know the purists in Israel are going to say Shamshon's not a name. So his name has to be Shimshon. It's like my grandfather's name was Hebrew name was Asher, but my grandmother insisted that it's not Asher, it's Usher. So we tried to explain to her many times, well, Usher is just the Yiddish, but it's really Asher. But no, it's for her, the name was Usher, not Asher. What time is it? Okay, we've got 5 more minutes. I mentioned last time that we dealt with Rav Hirschel Schechter, and I said that I made a joke that his last letter to me will be in volume 2. Not that I think there'll be a volume 2, but maybe, you never know. I don't have the same Yetzer to constantly send these letters, like maybe with 5 children and all this. I don't have the time, but I did send him one, and I mentioned last class because I said that although he's a great posek and his psukim are followed all over America, he doesn't say, you know, that you have to follow me. It's nothing like that. There's no Das Torah or anything like that. And then I actually said, it doesn't say Kibbu Daiti. And then later I realized maybe that's yeshivish, but in Hebrew, it's actually Kablu Daiti. It's PL. So it's like Dabru Kablu. He doesn't say accept my opinion. And actually wrote this to me in the letter, which I mentioned last class. So someone asked me, what did I send him about? That I said that people have a different opinion. So it's worth sharing this as well before we begin today, that if you go on the YU Torah website, you see that, remember at the beginning of COVID, I guess in Canada, unfortunately, it might be Nogea this Shabbos also, the porch minyanim. In Israel, you saw the videos in the apartment buildings, everyone goes on their porch and you can count everyone and they daven together. Question is, can you count everyone in a minyan? And incidentally, the anyone who's interested, there's been so many volumes put out about halachic writings about COVID, and the Mizrahi put one out also. This is, it's Sorba Mirabanan and halachic perspectives on the coronavirus. This has what I'm talking about now as well from Rav Schechter. It has his letter there, his tshuva, in which he explains why the porch minyanim are no good, that you have to be, and he gives the halachic sources, you have to be together. So let's say all of us would come out on our front lawn, we all see each other, we all hear each other, it still doesn't count as a minyan, or in Israel, when they're all in an apartment, they're together. What I did was, I sent him, we're going to see today the last letter from Rabbi Mazuz that we're going to do. And I mean, we've done a lot with him, but today we'll see the last one. Well, I sent Rabbi Schechter something for Rabbi Mazuz. Rabbi Mazuz disagrees. And I don't want to get into the various halachic details back and forth. And that's in the response. Rabbi Schechter said, well, I never said you have to listen to me. That's my opinion. Take it if you want, but don't. Quite apart from any halachic argumentation, Rabbi Mazuz says as follows. I printed it out, but I'm not sure which issue of the Bayit Naaman, but he says there's a better source, and he quotes the Chidah, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, a figure we've spoken about a great deal. He wrote a commentary on a Shulchan Aruch, it's called Machzik Bracha, and if you look in Orach Chaim, section 55:11, he talks about how he says, oh, I gotta pull this word up for you, because this is a word I did not know about. Maybe some of you knew about it. Hold on. Yes. Okay. The Chidah refers to the following. Let me share my screen with you. Here's an Italian word that I didn't know, but now I do know. Lazaretto. It's an isolation hospital for people with infectious diseases. So in 55, he says as follows. He says, "Belazaretto shenogi ba'arim ha'ele." He says concerning the Lazaretto that is commonly used in our cities, That is, if you you put people in isolation, and he says there's two groups. He says our cities. He's in Italy, so you have various epidemics. So you put them in one house. He gives a whole description of it, where a group of the people are in one house and a group of the people are across the way, let's say across the street in another house, so they can see each other and they can hear each other. They open the windows and they can daven. Can you count them together? He says they can't be together because the rules of the government, but they can go, they can see each other. And he, the Chida, and the Chida is a very, very important person. And the Chida claims that since some poskim say that this is allowed, you can rely on them. And Rabbi Mazuz, he quotes this Chida, and he says, what would the Chida say about what's today? When we're not dealing with individuals, Anashim Mesuyamim, who are in a lazaretto. Rather, the whole year, the whole city is in lockdown. And Rav Mazuz says, Vadai sheyesh hakel. Certainly we have to be, we can permit it. And according to the Chida, we can count them. And he says it's even a kal vachomer, because the Chida is referring to people who were, across the street and everything, who are across the street from each other. He says, us, we're dealing with the mirpasot. He's talking about in the apartments. He says, it's not across the street. We're all on the same side. It's just that one guy's on top of me. And he says, as long as the shliach tzibur can see everyone. And, it's a little problematic though, because if you're on, I don't know, if you're on these apartment buildings, you really can't see the people above. I guess they can, because you can lean over and they can lean over. It doesn't mean you have to see them every second. I mean, look, if you're davening, you don't see the people behind you. It means that you could see them. Then it's okay. So that's what I sent to Rabbi Mazuz, Rabbi Schachter, and I think Rabbi Mazuz makes a strong case that, because what are you going to do? You're not going to have tefillah b'tzibur? You'd have months without tefillah b'tzibur. So if the Chida is before Rav Avadi Yosef, the only figure the Sfardim referred to as Maran was Rav Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Chida. Now they have a third Maran. So it was mi Yosef ad Yosef, they said. From Yosef Karo until Yosef, the Chida, Chaim Yosef Dov Dozlai, none has appeared like Yosef. And we spoke in the previous class why if you go to Livorno today, you don't see his grave. I have a couple other things, but I'll save for next week, including, I'll just say one more thing, including from, which I need a few minutes, we don't have time now, which Mel just mentioned, Dr. Montalto. I'll tell you some stuff about riding in a carriage on Shabbos. Interesting stuff. We'll save for next week, God willing. I just want to answer Baruch and other people's questions. They asked about the Lubavitch Rebbe, the letter to my father, the lengthy letter. Did he write it? Was an assistant? From speaking to Rav Nachum Shmaryahu, this is what I assume. The Rebbe would dictate letters like this to Rabbi Mindel, who then would write up a draft, and the Rebbe would then edit, and that's why you have the Rebbe's handwriting on it. So that's what I assume it is. It's not like the Rebbe would write by hand. Okay, my friends. As always, we got great stuff today. Although as we do come near the end, we're about 40 pages from the end. We also have something that's troubling. For those of you who come from Germany, I think you're going to have a hard time with this, but what can we do? We're not interested in covering up things over here. We're trying to tell the truth as it is. But we're beginning on page Kufnun Gimel. Sorry, no, Shin Lamed Aleph, 331, Simon Kufnun Gimel. And it's the last letter from Rabbi Mazuz. I believe there are 32 letters. I am happy that I was able to introduce you to this enormous, unusual, really unique Talmud Chacham, not even our generation, but in multiple generations. That doesn't mean I share his politics or other things, but that's irrelevant. We're not in the Haredi, I'm not in the Haredi world, and even in the Haredi world, you don't have to share the politics of the Gedolim. But in terms of his insight and Torah knowledge, we're dealing with something really unique. The title of the responsum is as follows. Ha'im Mesadrei HaTalmud Bavli Ra'u Et HaTosefta. Did the editors of the Babylonian Talmud see the Tosefta? The Tosefta is a Tannaitic text you find in the back of all the Gemaras. Shaul Lieberman made his fame on publishing the Tosefta. When you think about it, it's significant because if they would announce tomorrow that they discovered, let's say, new Tannaitic writings that no one knew about, they discovered these new writings, everyone would be going crazy. They'd want to go see them, and yeshivas, they'd be very excited. What do they need to be so excited for? You have the Tosefta. It's in the back of every Gemara. It's a Tannaitic writing. It's been around since the beginning, and no one learns it. You go to yeshiva, they never open up. So what do I need to discover a new Tannaitic writing and get excited about? Here we have the Tosefta, Tannaitic writings, which no one pays any attention to. So I don't think we need any new materials. But the Tosefta is very important if you want to understand the Tannaitic literature. So why did I, what's the question all about? So here I need to show you something, which relates to my last book, the book on, not this book, the book Changing the Immutable, because there's simply an incredible Talmudic text. Those who do Daf Yomi know it. It's hard to know what to make of this. I spent a good deal of time on it, and here it is. It's an Erevin, page 51a, and it says as follows. I'll just summarize. Oh, here it says, Rabba and Rav Yosef are having a discussion. And he quotes Rabbi Rabba says to Rav Yosef that it's taught in a Brisa that Rabbi Yossi says, and he gives the view of Rabbi Yossi. It's not important for now exactly what was said. But then the Gemara says, and this is the, using Halivni's language, this is the Stam. This is the editor of the Gemara. We already spoke earlier about editors. So you have the Talmud. Someone put this all together, the anonymous editors. So the filler, much of the give and take are not the Amoraim, it's the later figures. They call them the Stam, the Savarim, whatever you want to call them. So what is the comment? The Gemara comments. That's how the English Steinsalt. So who's the Gemara? The Gemara is the unknown editor. But it is not so. That is not the opinion of Rabbi Yossi. So in other words, Rabba told Rabbi Yosef, this is what Rabbi Yossi says. But the Gemara says it's not true. That's not the opinion of Yossi. Rabba only taught it as if it is in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, so that Rabbi Yosef would accept it from him, due to the fact that Rabbi Yossi's reasonings accompanies his rulings. Since Rabbi Yossi had good reasonings. And they explain, since the halacha is usually in accord with Rav Yossi's opinion, Rav Yosef would be less likely to raise doubts in regard to the ruling. So this is an unbelievable passage, because here you have, they're having a discussion, and Rabba tells Rav Yosef that, this is the answer because Rabbi Yossi said it. Then the Gemara says, but Rabbi Yossi never said it. This is Rabba's opinion, but Rabba's attributing it to Rav Yossi so that Rav Yosef would accept it. Whatever happened to basic honesty? How can you falsely attribute? This is a famous passage. It's hard to know what to make of it. Everyone discusses it. The Magen Avraham quotes it. If you assume that this is okay, that if you're convinced of the truth of something, you can falsely attribute it, then what are you going to do about the Masorah? How can you rely on anyone? So that's, if you're interested, you can help me on my tuition bills. You can order tonight, Changing the Immutable. And then I discuss it in great detail in the last chapter. But that's not what I want to discuss with you now. What I want to discuss with you now is something else, that the Tosefta, actually what the Gemara says, that Rav Yossi never said this. However, if you look in the Tosefta in Erevin 3:16, lo and behold, the same thing is quoted and Rav Yossi's name is attached to it. In other words, the Gemara is wrong. The Gemara says Rav Yossi didn't say it, but yet we have the Tosefta that he did say it. What's going on here? So I say the Gemara is wrong now. I'm being maybe a little flippant. I don't know if in yeshiva you could say the Gemara is wrong, but that's exactly what we're going to see. Well, that's what I'll tell you what my Zeus says. So when I first was learning the Sugya, and lo and behold, the Gemara says that Rabba just made this up, because Rabbi Yossi had good logic, which of course has to be troubling to anyone who believes in honesty, and it's a problem, which the Achronim discuss. And they give different approaches to it. One approach, which tries to lessen, I guess, the breach, says that what it means is that Rabba actually had a tradition, but it just wasn't attributed to someone. But it's not like it's not his view. It's an ancient tradition he has. But so the falsehood is in attributing it Raviosi. But others say no. Others say that this was his idea, but in order to get it to be accepted, he falsely attributed it. But then I find that, lo and behold, the Tosefta actually has it with Raviosi's name about to it. So clearly the Gemara, the Stam, was unaware of this, and what it said is not true. So I asked Rabbi Mazuz about this, because, you know, what I don't exactly want to say that the Gemara was unaware or the Gemara is wrong. It's not really a pleasant thing to say. So I write to him, and he says as follows, that your comment about Erevin 51b from the Tosefta, already the Gaon Rav Yeshaya Pick was aware of this and pointed this out in his comments. Rav Yeshaya Pick, he's the one who does the Ein Mishpat in the Gemara, but one of the great Gaonim. And then this is Rabbi Mazuz. And I have to read it in Hebrew again, because he might not believe me. V'zo achat ha'ochachot sha'tosefta shelanu lo haital einei mesadrei Talmud Bavli. This is one of the proofs that the editors of the Babylonian Talmud did not have the Tosefta. In other words, because if they had a Tosefta, they couldn't have said that Rabbah made this up or Rabbah said it. It's not true. They didn't have it. They didn't know this. So since they didn't have such a tradition, they assumed that this was a false attribution, but it's not. So on the one hand, that's great, I think, because then all of a sudden Rabbah is not falsely attributing it to it, and all the problems you might have fall by the wayside. And the halachic conclusions that people derive from this, you can still derive them. Of course, this raises the other question, then. What about the Gemara, the Stam? How often are you going to say that? And the truth is that this is a major feature of the academic study of the Talmud. Anyone who went to Yeshiva University, you might remember Professor Feldboom. He came from a traditional Talmudic background, but then he becomes a student of Avraham Weiss at YU, and he becomes an academic practitioner of Talmud study. David Weiss Halivni, not Lieberman. Lieberman is a traditional Pshat Talmudist. The academic study of the Talmud assumes that, and they don't just do this occasionally, this is like their general derech, assumes that the Mesadrei HaTalmud, it's not just that they didn't know the Tosefta, they didn't know a lot of things. They didn't have many traditions. They didn't know about Halachic Midrashim. They didn't know about the Yerushalmis often. And the conclusion of the academic Talmudists is that, therefore, we can offer different explanations for problems in the Gemara than the Gemara offers. In other words, the Gemara will call attention to a contradiction between the two brises. And we all know it. Anyone who learns Gemara knows this. And then the Gemara will give an answer. And the answer of the Gemara is often a far-fetched answer. Like they'll say, well, it must be referring to this case. And it's like a strange far-out case. And you're left wondering, well, if that's what the Mishnah intended, why didn't it say it? For this academic critical study of the Talmud, it's really higher criticism of Talmud, they will say that, no, that's just the Gemara trying to come up with an answer. But now we can give a better answer because we have the Tosefta, we have the Talmud. It's quite controversial to do this, needless to say. Although you find this in the Rambam, you find this in a number of Rishonim. Tosas Yom Tov says there's no problem explaining the Gemara different than the Mishnah, as long as you don't change halacha. Sorry, explain the Mishnah different than Gemara, as long as you don't explain halacha, violate halacha. The difference, of course, is that these, when you find the Rishonim, the Rambam, even the Gra, it's ad hoc, it's occasionally, it's like a case like this. But the academic approach to the Talmud does it page after page. That's their assumption. It's not like occasionally you might say the Mesadrei HaTalmud were unaware of the Tosefta, and now we can explain the Mishnah differently than them. Like I said, the Rambam does that. But you're talking about a few times here and there. That's different than saying we're going to have a whole approach, page after page, where we're going to do this. That's what Halivni does. The originator of this was a person in Eastern Europe. His name is Hirsch Penelis, Rabbi Hirsch Penelis. And he wrote a book called Darka Shel Torah, The Way of Torah. His brother-in-law was so upset about this book, he wrote another book in opposition to him, Kachi Darka Shel Torah. This is the way of Torah. One wonders when they got together for Pesach or something, because the brother-in-law was very upset. Then the next practitioner of this is the famous Rabbi Dunner from Amsterdam. We have some people sometimes with us from Amsterdam. He's a posek, he's a regular Rav, but in his private commentaries, Chidushi Ritzad, that's what he does. He's a practitioner of the academic study of Talmud, and his attitude was, as long as we accept the Gemara in terms of practical halacha, it doesn't matter what else we say. So you should be aware that this is a very interesting approach. If you ever go to take an academic study, academic Talmud course, that's like the basis of it. But so that's what Rabbi Mazur says. And then he goes on and he says, he gives some other examples, just some other examples that off the top of his head, I guess, which shows you that the editors of the Talmud did not know the Tosefta. It's interesting that because he's coming right from a traditional background to say that. That's Siman Kuf Nun Gimel. The next tshuva, Kuf Nun Dalet, is from another figure we've spoken about a good deal. This will be the second to last one we hear of him. The next one we hear of him will be next week. That's the Art Scroll situation where Rabbi Rappaport did great service in what he found out. And here he is, Rabbi Chaim Rappaport from London. You can also on Torah in Motion. He has a couple things on Torah in Motion. Very brilliant Talmud Chacham. And he's dealing with a different issue relating to something I wrote. And he, I wrote an article on the Rambam and Superstition, which then it was included in my book, Studies in Maimonides and His Interpreters, although much expanded. And in there, I dealt with Rav Avraham ben Arambam. We spoke about Rav Avraham ben Arambam a few classes ago, and his book, The Maspik Ovdei Hashem. Rav Avraham ben Arambam says as follows. The title of the tshuva is B'divrei Rav Avraham ben Arambam, concerning Rav Avraham ben Arambam, shechachamim natnu tam l'takonoteyam l'vidat hashomim, that the sages would give a reason for their decrees in accordance with the ideas of the listeners, the masses, let's say, not the real reason. In other words, that the sages would sometimes give a reason for a takana, but that's not the real reason. Why they would not give the real reason, we shall see in a second, at least according to Rav Avraham ben Arambam. Rav Avraham ben Arambam, in his book, Sefer HaMaspik, he talks about Mayim Achronim. What's the source of the obligation for Mayim Achronim? The Gemara says, because of this Melech Sodomis, this harsh Sodom salt, the very dangerous harsh type of salt, if you get it in your eyes or whatever it is. And what is, and then of course, that we have the permission today that since we don't have that sort of, we don't have that anymore, therefore you don't need to be makbid on Mayim Achronim, although some people are, maybe Hasidim are, sometimes people are makbid on Shabbos, but generally people are not, and there's a reason, there's a heter not to be. Rav Avraham ben Arambam says as follows, if you look at the sources, at the Talmud, you would assume, I mean, this is what it says, that the reason for the obligation of Mayim Achronim is because of Melech Sodomis. We see that it's taken seriously in the Gemara, Rav Avraham ben Arambam says. In fact, it says that in the Gemara that Rishonim, Mayim Rishonim is a mitzvah, Vachronim is chova. That the word chova, obligation, is even more significant, I guess because of sakana, maybe danger. But Mayim Achronim is taken more seriously than Mayim Rishonim. And it also says in the Gemara in Erevin that it speaks about how if like you're in a camp away from everyone, that you're putter in Mayim Rishonim, you're chayiv in Mayim Achronim. And then Rav Avraham and Rambam says, what's the reason for this? Mayim Achronim, why do they take it so seriously? He says it's Mishum Hachana. It's really because it's preparation of benching, Birkas HaMazon, which is a Torah commandment. We know that Torah commandment, Bracha Achrona, the second, the Bracha at the end of the meal, is a Torah obligation. Ve'achalta v'savata v'erachta. The Bracha Rishona, that's a rabbinic obligation. It's interesting to think about it because you see what the Christians do. They always, you know, they say grace. It's always before the meal. It never would occur to, let's say, a non-Jew to do grace after the meals because you've already eaten it. So maybe that's why it's a doraisa, because you never would assume to make the bracha after the meal. Therefore, you need to be told doraisa. But derabbanan, the rabbis on their own say to do this because that's before you eat. It makes sense to do it. So the Torah has to tell you to do something that you wouldn't necessarily do on your own, but bracha rishona, it's almost like it's a muskal rishon, to use the medieval philosophical expression. It's an obvious thing. So Rav Avraham and Rambam says that the reason we do mayim achronim is preparation. He thinks this is the real reason. Even though what the Gemara says, he doesn't. He says this is the real reason, because your preparation of birkas hamazon, which is daraisa, and he calls it tefila katana, it's a small prayer. It's like tefila. And then he says, but the sages connected it to this, connected this obligation with sakana, with a danger, and they gave this as the reason, according to the halacha. Why? So that people would be careful and not, blow it off. Why would they be careful? Because of danger. Rav Avraham ben Arambam says that the real reason for mayim achronim is because it's preparation, so that we're right before, like it's a washing, before we do the daraisa commandment to bench. But the sages, to ensure that people would take it seriously and not just finish eating and quickly bench, not do mayim achronim, they connected it to something which it really isn't. It has nothing to do with this danger. But this is not true. But they connected it to that. So this is interesting, first of all. There are Rav Avraham ben Arambam, with no source at all, as far as I know, assumes that the sages would sometimes give you I'll tell you what led him to this, what he quotes his father as saying, but the sages would give you a reason, but that's not the real reason. And the reason is only being given for the masses. This actually would work very well, perhaps with the Vilna Gaon's position. The Vilna Gaon doesn't say this exactly. The Vilna Gaon says that the reasons given in the Talmud are not the only reasons. So therefore, if the reason doesn't apply anymore, it doesn't mean you can get rid of it because there's other reasons. But the Vilna Gaon is not going on to say that the whole reason is just a fraud. I wouldn't say fraud, but is just a reason for the masses to keep them in line. I don't know what word to use for that. Actually, I know what word to use for it. It's the word we used already, what the Rambam says in the Mar Nevuchim. It's a necessary belief. It's not a true belief, it's a necessary belief. Emunah hechrachit. So why is Rav Avraham ben Arambam inspired to come up with this idea? Because he quotes something the Rambam, his father, told him. The Rav Avraham ben Arambam's works are so important, not just because he's so important himself and of such interest in his relationship to Sufism. Professor Fishbane's son, who's a scholar, professor in his own right, Eitan Fishbane, Michael Fishbane's son, recently came out with a book on Rav Avraham and Arambam, and there's been a good written about him. We have a Syrian or two who listened to us, Rabbi Ezra Lapiton, who unfortunately died young, rabbi in Deal or Elberon or one of those places there. He wrote his doctoral dissertation at Brandeis University, which he completed not long before he passed away, also on Rav Avraham ben Arambam. I hope soon they will publish it. But Rav Avraham records traditions from his father, the Rambam, and he was young when his father died. I forget. Someone could check maybe. I think he was only 16. You know what? I'll just, rather than, what do I need to write at a computer here? I can tell you what year. We know all these things now. So he's born in 1186. And the Rambam died in, what do we say now? The Rambam died in 1204. So that makes him 18 years old. So what does he quote the Rambam as saying? And we mentioned this already, but now it's in context. He says, I quote the Rambam. The Rambam says about zugot. We spoke about zugot already. And you remember the Talmud says that pairs are a problem because the demons, and therefore the Gemara has to give a special reason why on Pesach we could have four at the Seder, the four cups. What does the Rambam say? He quotes his father as saying that this is to keep people away from dualism. That's what the prohibition on Zugot was about, because it's similar. The pagans used to do things in pairs. However, in order to keep people away from it, what did they do? They didn't tell them it's because of dualist ceremonies. Rather, they connected it to some sort of they connected it to a danger, namely that you're going to be harmed by demons, which the Rambam didn't believe in demons, of course, but he's saying that the sages themselves didn't believe there's a problem in demons and zugot, but the people believed in it. So therefore, you want to keep the people away from this dualist ceremonies. you give them a reason to keep them away. You tell them, hey, the demons are going to harm them, even though the sages know this is not the real reason. The real reason is to keep them away from Avodah Zarah, but you give them a different reason. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Do we have any examples of this today where the rabbis or in recent years, some of you will probably think of something where you give the people one reason, but that's really not the reason. The reason is something else, but if you tell them the real reason, they're not going to pay attention to it. So you give them this reason. This ties into the old question of the Chasam Sofer's idea of halot et ha'isur. Can you raise the level of an isur? It's sort of similar to that. And there are people who hold you can tell them that it's a Torah prohibition when it's only a rabbinic prohibition because it'll keep them away from it. But this is, I guess, it's similar related to that. So that's what he quotes his father as saying. And Rabbi Rappaport asks a question, though, because it appears from the Mishnah Torah that he held that this is the Mishnah Torah. He mentions that you have to keep away from Maim Achroni because of the danger. Even if it's he doesn't understand how Rav Avraham and Rambam felt able to adopt his father's ideas and take it one step further. In other words, take it from Zugot to Maim Achronim, when the Rambam himself explains that Maim Achronim is because of Melech Sodomis. And so Rav Avraham and Rambam is not following his father's explicit ruling in the Mishnah Torah, unless they're going to say that even in the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam is providing just the reason for the masses. Maybe. But that's so Rabbi Rappaport points this out, that it seems to contradict what he says there. And then he goes on and he points out a couple other things that he says that you can tie this together. Rabbi Rappaport points out that you can tie this idea of the Rambam, that you could attach something to a danger, even if that's not the real reason. And Rav Avraham ben Rambam does the same thing based on the Rambam's letter on astrology. In the Rambam's letter on astrology, he says that sometimes you will find things in the Talmud which are mistaken. I know to say this is going to get you put in chayrim in certain circles. That's what they did to Rabbi Slifkin. But that's what the Rambam says. And what's the example of things in the Talmud are mistaken? Astrology. You'll find things in astrology, the astrological stuff in the Talmud. And the Rambam says there's no such thing as astrology. So what to make of it? So the Rambam gives three answers here. We spoke about this in the past. Rabbi Rappaport repeats it. He says it could be that this sage was mistaken. An individual sage could be mistaken. The Rambam assumes that the sages as a whole will not fall into this trap of astrology or any other superstitions. His second thing is that even though the sages speak about superstition, speak about astrology, it's not to be taken literal. There's like a hint in their words. So it looks like they speak about astrology, but really has a deeper meaning. And the third answer is, he says as follows, they spoke l'fisha'a u'masa shahaya l'fanav. They spoke according to the needs of the times. And what does that mean according to the needs of the times? Rabbi Rappaport explains this by what the Meiri said. The Meiri also speaks about Zugot, and he has a different approach than the Rambam, at least in the Rambam quoted by Rav Avraham ben Rambam. The Meiri is very much influenced by the Rambam, and he doesn't accept demons either. If you go through the Meiri's writings, every single time there's a mention of demons, he rationalizes it. The Meiri says, however, that although the fear of Zugot is nonsense, but it was so ingrained in people's psyche, and since the belief in the harmful nature of Zugot is not a Avodah Zarah, it's not Darkei Amori, it's just a superstition, not only did the sages see no need to uproot this notion, they even supported it. How did they support it? Because when they discussed the Pesach situation, they gave a special reason why you can use Zugot at the Seder, the four cups. And the Meiri says, however, that since in our day no one pays attention to Zugot, you can disregard them entirely. But Meiri's point is that sometimes people are so attached to something that you don't need to uproot it, but rather than keeping it instead push it in a good direction or It could be zugot or related to idolatry, let's say. So instead, connect it to something else. The Rambam connects it to, you connect it to harm with demons. It's the same idea, actually, as what the Rambam and Rav Avram are saying, is that you connect it to something else, which is, I guess, harmless. The Meiri doesn't tell us what the real problem with zugot was, that the original reason that perhaps you have to connect it to a different thing. Maybe it is idolatry. I guess that's what he assumed. So Rabbi Rappaport quotes this, and he calls this an emtzai chinuchi. It's just like an educational method. I think he's correct on this. In fact, let me read you what the Meiri says. The Gemara says anyone who's particular about zugot, then the zugot are particular about you. If you're makpid on it, if you worry about it, then you need to be concerned. But if you don't care about it, you're okay. So how does the Meiri understand this? He says, "Dekafid kaftinan, dero kafid lo kaftinan, le shahayat tivam mekabel b'inyan chizuk." So the Rambam Meiri says this is all psychological. That what does it mean that if you're worried about zugot, then they can cause trouble to you? It means because psychologically, if you feel it's a problem, then it's going to bother you. If you don't feel it's a problem, it's not going to bother you. So obviously, that's not a real. There's no such thing as zugot in reality, but the people believed it. So the Meiri says, well, if the people believe it, and the reason they believe it, they say because of demons are not really, it doesn't create a religious problem. It's just a superstition. It's mistaken. It's okay to let them do it because I guess, as I said, although he doesn't explicitly say this, I guess the opposite would be sort of what the Rambam says, that they would assume that they would think zugot are harmful for idolatrous reasons or whatever. So that's the Siman 154. Now we're up to 155. Page 333, and this is the only letter that's not from a rabbi, although it was from a Talmud Chacham. His name was, let me find the page here, Professor Yaakov Levinger. You can find, I could get a picture of him. You have a Wikipedia page on him. He's the brother of Moshe Levinger, who was the rabbi in Chevron for so long. He's also another brother is Yisrael Meir Levinger. He was a rabbi in Basel, I believe, and in Germany. He's the world's expert on halacha of like animals. He's written books on halacha before Slifkin about Chulin and all sorts of other things. And then I saw, I'd never heard of him, the Israelis will know him, his Yaakov Levinger's son is Ido Levinger, who's an actor. He studied, actually, as it says, in the TV Meir in Har Tzion. And Yaakov Levinger, if you read his biography, it doesn't say here where he studied in yeshiva, I don't see. But he was a big Talmud Chacham, and he really wrote this first work on Darcho HaMachshava HaHilchotit Shel HaRambam. He wrote a whole work on the Rambam's halachic writings, the approach in the Mishnah Torah. If you're thinking of it, it's funny, but Isidore Twersky, he wrote a whole book on the Mishnah Torah. You read the entire volume of Isidore Twersky, my teacher, Introduction to the Code of Maimonides, there's nothing in it on halacha. It's everything about the Mishnah Torah, but nothing really the Mishnah Torah. So he'll talk about language. He'll talk about that classic chapter on philosophy, his influence and all that, but nothing about the Rambam's approach to halacha. That's why it's an introduction, but it doesn't give you into the meat. Levinger gets you into the meat of it. So why did I write to Levinger? Because it's also about this issue of superstitions that I was dealing with, and it relates to this book. The Hilchot Yerushalmi of the Rambam. The Rambam wrote this work we spoke about. He wrote a work on, it's called Hilchot Yerushalmi. The Rambam mentions this. If you read Lieberman's, it was edited by Shaul Lieberman's introduction, he gives you the sources. The Rambam refers to this work, Hilchot Yerushalmi, and he tells you what it is. He says in one of his tshuvot that he's going to do with the Yerushalmi just what the Rif, Rav Isaac Alfasi, did with the Bavli. On my Pesach program, there was someone who was there who also traveled to Spain, and he asked me, have I ever heard of Lucena? And I said, well, yeah, that's the Rif was in Lucena as yeshiva. And he said, I've asked all these Talmid Chachamim, all people from yeshiva students. No one's ever heard of Lucena. So I said, well, you know, when we go to Spain, we speak about Lucena. So then he says, was I ever in Lucena? I said, no, I've never been to Lucena. And he's telling me I have to go because they uncovered recently some graves. So they did there's a whole exhibition on it. There's nothing to see. There's no tombstones. They just discovered a place where they think is the old Jewish cemetery. So they have this whole sign. They have a sign all about the Jewish life in Lucena. I don't know if it's worth it. I guess if you pass right by it on the highway, but I don't know if it's worth it even driving a half hour to see that, because who knows if it's even really a Jewish cemetery. And even if it is, there's nothing to see. There's no cemeteries in Spain. There's not one matseva that you can see in Spain on the ground. You'll see matsevas. We saw them in Barcelona on the wall. They're in the buildings, but nothing in the ground. But why would the Rambam write such a work, a riff on the Yerushalmi? Well, because sometimes you use Yerushalmi. The Rambam, it's difficult to understand, but there's different opinions as to when the Rambam uses the Yerushalmi. Sometimes the Rambam uses Yerushalmi. And one approach is that the Rambam feels he can use the Yerushalmi against the Bavli when the conclusion in the Bavli is clearly just from the Stam, the Masader, the Bavli. So if you have a choice between Yerushalmi and a final decision in the Bavli, but the final decision is being made by, let's say, the Savarayim, it doesn't necessarily have to bind you. That's one approach. And there's other approaches. So, but whatever it is, so he writes this work. We have his handwriting. There was a scholar, Binyamin Zev Benedict of Haifa, also a great Talmud Chacham and a scholar, academic scholar. He argued against Lieberman. He said that it's not, the Rambam didn't write it. He tried to show contradictions. He didn't really argue about the handwriting. I mean, handwriting experts have all concluded that it's the Rambam's handwriting. So he had the scholarship uniformly accepts that this is from the Rambam. Unlike the commentaries of the Rambam to, let's say, Masechas Rosh Hashanah and other works, which we know are not by the Rambam. But I had a problem because I'm learning through the Hilchos Yerushalmi, and lo and behold, on pages 19 to 20, it's speaking about Kriya Shema Al Hamita, the evening Kriya Shema, the night Kriya Shema, when you go to sleep. And this just quotes the Yerushalmi. And what does he quote? And it's exactly what appears in the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi is not like the Bavli. There's not as much demons in the Yerushalmi, but occasionally they have. And what is the reason? It quotes Rav Yosef, that you have to do the Shema in your house in the night. Bishvil Havriach Es Hamazikin, in order to chase away the demons. But that's why you, and that's said explicitly in the Bavli, in Brachos, right at the beginning of Masechet Brachot. You have to see what page it's on to get rid of the demons. Yerushalmi agrees. What's going on here? How could the Rambam, who, if you read my article, you see that every time demons are mentioned, he either reinterprets it. What do I mean by reinterpret it? So, the Gemara speaks about where if you have to give a warning, hasara, to someone before they commit a crime. So they talk about if you don't hear if you don't see or hear the person giving hasara, you know, like a demon. So the Gemara says like a demon giving hasara. It still counts. The Rambam, he takes out the demonic element and just says, if you don't hear the person. Sorry, now if you don't see the person. In other words, the Gemara says, the demon who you don't see gives you hasra, don't kill this person, it's still good hasra. What does the Rambam do? When he puts in the Mishnah Torah, he doesn't mention demon, he simply says, if you hear it, but don't see the person giving you hasra, that's a reinterpretation. Other examples, the Rambam just omits it, because he thinks it's not, like we said, with the letter in astrology, he doesn't accept it, he thinks that it's a mistaken view. Here you have Hilchos Yerushalmi, where the Rambam is quoting things halacha lemaisa, only halacha here, and giving reasons for it, and he says it's because of the demons. Isn't this a proof that the Rambam could not have written Hilchos Yerushalmi? So Lieberman takes it up, and Lieberman in his note here says, because obviously the Rambam doesn't believe in demons, Barur sha'Rambam pirei sha'kavana l'mazikin b'nei adam. It must be that the Rambam is speaking about mazikin, humans. So in other words, you recite Kriya Shema Al Hamita because that'll keep bad people away from you. to say that this is what we call in yeshiva dochak is putting it mildly. Every time the Gemara refers to mazikin in this sort of way, it always refers to demons. And it's hard to believe that that's what the Rambam means, but that's what Lieberman, what else are you going to say? So I asked Levinger, an expert in the halachic writings of the Rambam, what he thinks is going on here. And he replies to me as follows. And the title of the responsum is Yichusosha Hilchus Yerushalmi LaRambam, the attribution of Hilchus Yerushalmi to the Rambam. He says, I have no opinion regarding the authorship of the Rambam on Hilchus Yerushalmi, and it appears to me, and I think I've never expressed an opinion. He says, the proofs of Lieberman never convinced me. Now, Lieberman, his biggest proof is we know the Rambam tells you what he's going to write, that it's like a riff on the Yerushalmi, which this is exactly what that is. And we know no other example of any Rishon who wrote such a work. We have no evidence. So, and he gives other reasons. He compares, it's a little hard. I mean, he compares the Rambam's positions in Hilchos Yerushalmi to what he writes elsewhere. So yes, you see plenty of things where they agree. On the other hand, what do you do when they disagree, like in this case? But Levinger says, everything comes down to, in his opinion, if this is the handwriting of the Rambam. In Hilchos Yerushalmi, in the back, there's a whole long page there from Moshe Lutzky, who was a handwriting expert, dealt with manuscripts, who says 100% it's the Rambam's handwriting. But that's what he said the question is. And if it is from the Rambam, Levinger says, I don't find the quote about the Mazikian problematic. Why not? How could it not be problematic? He says, we don't know the criteria which the Rambam wrote Hilchos Yerushalmi. It could be that, he says, it could be in this case that Lieberman is correct, which I don't think so, but it could be that the Rambam would include ideas that he didn't accept halachically. That is, it could be that this isn't like a Mishnah Torah. This is more of a, see, the Hilchos Yerushalmi, everything he's quoting is word for word from the Gemara. He just leaves out the agadic stuff. It's just like the riff, quoting word for word without his own input. It could be, Levinger says, that the Rambam, since this isn't his own independent work, he would cite the halacha and also the reason, even if he didn't accept the basis for this. For the reason, could be, but that's something you should be aware of. Do we have? Yes, I think we have time now to at least introduce the next letter, number 156. It's the last one we will see from Rabbi Ratzabi, the Yemenite, the leading Yemenite authority in the non-Dardai community. Here he is. It's the Yemenites, as we spoke about, are divided into two communities, the Dardaim and the non-Dardaim, that is those who accept Kabbalah and those who really don't accept it. He's from the side that do. And this is going to be problematic, so I'll just introduce it and we'll get into it next class, because it's, if it was just the academic world saying it, you can divide it between what I'm going to say between the academic and not. But many Torah authorities, including Rav Ratzabi, also speak about this. And that's, it's the title of it is the authenticity of the Sefer HaEshkol in the edition of Rav Tzvi Binyamin Auerbach, Mahaduras Auerbach. Incidentally, let me, about editions, I heard from someone the other day that the great editor, Avram Shoshana from Ofek, he edits, they come out with many good works from manuscript, that he's very upset that Art Scroll calls its Talmuds the Schatzenstein edition or the Tzucker Mikros Gedolos, because he says, no, an edition should only be by the name of the editor. So the Chavel edition of the Ramban, the Auerbach edition of the Eshkol, the Sofer edition of Meiri, the Lieberman edition. You don't give donors the title of an edition. It's very nice they donated the money, but it's not their edition. You have the editor is the one who does all the work. So that's an interesting thing. I have to say, I never thought of that before, but the more I think about it, I think it's correct. An edition should be the one who edited it. So that means, of course, we can't speak about an edition of the Talmud because the Mesadrim, we don't know who they are. But what we're going to talk about next class is this individual, this rabbi, important rabbi in Germany, Binyamin Hirsch, or Zvi Binyamin Auerbach, rabbi in Halberstadt. He edited the Eshkol. Eshkol is an important medieval halachic work. He did other things as well, but the Eshkol is his big thing. I just noticed today that if you go online on Wikipedia, I don't know who put this in, you have a whole entry here, the Nachal Eshkol controversy, which we will speak about. But lo and behold, if you look at the notes, 3, 4, 5, 6, these are all me. 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm the one who's written about it in the English language. There's a lot in the Hebrew, but I'm the only one to write about it in English. And I collected all the halachic sources on it and all the academic sources. Is it possible that a great rabbi, communal rabbi, posek, forged a text? Is that even something we can imagine? And yet we have Torah authorities who say absolutely that that's the case. And I have to tell you the whole controversy. I'll speak about the Eshkol. The Eshkol has halachic significance. Fasting, what we do on fast days, if you fly in an airplane from Israel to America, when do you end the fast day? Do you keep fasting and fasting because it's remaining light and light? This is the heter is going to go back to the Eshkol and all sorts of other interesting things. But this is it's going to be a difficult thing. I'm just going to tell you what they say. I'm not here to cover it up. What the, including German Orthodox scholars have said. I don't know what to make of it, but I'll just tell you about it, and we will speak about that next class. We're also going to speak about another scandal, a scandal that to this day has not been rectified. That is what Art Scroll did to the great Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. We have to be very thankful for Rabbi Rappaport, the research he did in speaking with the family. We'll do that next time. And then we'll back to Rav Herschel Schechter about Rav Shaul Lieberman, about Rav Yaakov Weinberg. Oh, sorry, one more from Rav Mazuz. Maybe we'll get to. And then, not next class, but maybe after that, we get into Hungarian Orthodoxy. I know we have some Hungarians with us. So I see it's already 9:28. So let me stop here. I'm very happy that we're all together again. I even got an email from one of you saying that you felt like you missed out because 3 weeks we didn't have any of our classes. So thank you very much for that. Let me take the comments here and the questions. Baruch said the Yeshiva Flatbush has had Arvis Chagigis for years on evening of Yom Ha'atzmaus. Thank you very much for Baruch. Although that's not a shul, that's a school. I think also there's a Mizrahi Minyan in Flatbush. I think they do as well. Okay, in KMS they do it. When I say Chagigis, I mean, hold on. I don't mean like when I lived in the Upper West Side, you'd go to the shul and they'd have a chazan. And they do a little chazanis. What I'm talking about, what's in the RCA Siddur, where you begin Ma'ariv, Hodu Hashem Ki Tov, and then you do, they have here three paragraphs of Ocha Dodi, and then you have a Shir Malos, and then Shachris, you do a Yom Tov Shachris, and then a Haftarah. That's what I'm referring to. I know in Canada, it's very B'nai Akiva. I've mentioned a few times, I grew up, we never heard of B'nai Akiva. Moshava, where I sent my kids. All my kids, and it's 2 hours from my house. It's very close, and yet never knew anyone who went there. We were all NCSY, we were all Morasha. Where I grew up, we never heard of B'nai Akiva. Truth be told, I don't know if I should say it, but I will. I started sending my kids to Moshavah because it was cheaper. It was cheaper than the other ones, but we ended up loving it. It was great, and one thing I did not like about it, I'll say it, because I think it's a big mistake, and my kids were very upset with it. On July 4th at Moshavah, they do nothing. Zilch. I don't know if I mentioned this. It's like, which is wrong. You're in America. Every other camp does something. Morasha, Nesher, all that. It's July 4th. You're not in Israel. If you're Zohar to go to Israel, you don't have to do July 4th. On our trips, July 4th, we always do something nice on the trips. And the Canadians join in also. But for a camp in America, come on, Lear. Fine, teach them to go to Aliyah. But you're in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, wherever you are. July 4th, you should do something, some fireworks. That bothers me. But other than that, I love it. Rav Charlap used to do the special Yom HaTzmaut service at Young Israel of Moshu Parkway, at least for my Riv. In the morning, we only did challah with a bracha. Okay, I didn't even know about that. And I find that interesting because Rabbi Charlap was very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but he's closer, I guess, in the spiritual sense to his grandfather. But I don't know his grandfather's position because the chief rabbinate never permitted it with a bracha until Rav Gorin came in. But I don't know what Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap... Someone wrote to me that many of the original letters are in the Sanger collection. Oh, that's referring to Hirschian letters. Okay. Yaakov Yellen says, and I know he'll be upset with me. He'll be a little embarrassed, but Yaakov Yellen, who's with us, has a wonderful podcast. I'll send the link of working in Disney, and maybe we'll hear from him one day about the Torah values of working in business, because I learned that he wrote a dissertation about Torah values in the business world, and he'd be a wonderful person to share that with us. So, sorry, Yaakov, but yeah, it's wonderful. I'll send the link to anyone who's interested. Koren has a special machzor for Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim that has all these tefillos you mentioned and more. Very interesting. Yom Yerushalayim especially it doesn't have the same issues as Yom HaTzmaut. All I can say is I must have not grown up in a very religious Zionist area because I never heard of it growing up. Rabbi Kalman says, it sure appears that most here disagrees with there are many backyard minyanim. Backyard minyanim. But is a backyard, we're not talking about backyard minyanim. We're talking about a porch minyan where you're each in your own porch.
And so here they're each in their own backyard. So, and their trees blocking. And you can.
Okay, so you're right. That would be Rav Mazuz, not Rav Shechter.
They're yes. Not 10 people in the same backyard generally.
Okay, so Rav Shechter does not agree with that. And he explains why. I think, if not mistaken, either he or someone else cites an example from the Karban Pesach. When you eat it, you have to eat it together. But Rav Asher Weiss is makel. Rav Asher Weiss also thinks, if you look in that Mizrahi book, there it quotes Rav Asher Weiss. But it seems Rav Asher Weiss is almost a Das Yachid. All the other sources, as I recall, they're not so crazy about this.
It's interesting. And at the minyan I go to, they do something which I'm not crazy about, but okay, they do it. When they call me up, I do the same thing. They give an aliyah and you're 50 feet away from the person leaning the Torah. And they give seven. In certain minyanim, the Baal Kori gets all seven aliyahs. But in the minyan I Devon, they asked the Rav in the neighborhood, and he said, so the person stands 25 feet away from the Torah and says, Baruch Hu Hashem Avarach. And they give me aliyahs. That's what I do.
Okay,
I'm sure many would disagree with that, but Beseda, listen, it's a Sharat Chak, and people come to Minyan, they kept the Minyan going.
And remember, the whole idea of Aliyah today is sort of, it's not the original thing, you're not reading the Torah, so does it ever say anywhere that you have to actually, I mean, you're supposed to follow along,
right.
You're supposed to read it, but it's right. Not Meyakim.
So that's what they're saying, you know, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And it's okay. Good.
So Baruch says, it's the special Tefillah Arvi Chagigi, blending both Ashkenazic and Sephardic traditions, very nice, okay. Rabbi Yellen says the Tzorva volume quotes some sources that allow it. Yes, it's when the minyan are separated by different spaces, like on different porches. The Rav Shechter doesn't allow what you mean. Yeah, it doesn't. Yes, sorry, thank you. Rabbi Kelman says, how about the Chasam Sofer says, let's treat a minyan like a biblical law. Okay, that was what I was sort of alluding to, but he goes more. He says that you can lahalot at ha'isur, you can raise the level of an isur. What he there is saying is that you could tell people if it's just asay, you could tell them it's a los asay also. And other those extrapolate to say that you can say that a rabbinic prohibition is a Torah prohibition. This is all in my last book, you'll find it. Joel says, how did Rabbah not know whom to attribute it? The Gemara says, because Rav Yossi was known to have good reasoning. That is, he was known to be someone respected. I don't know what to make of this. Someone said to me, someone very high up in YU said, if we accept this position, which is quoted, by the way, in the Magen Avraham, that you can falsely attribute, then what do you do with Nefesh HaRav? Because if Rav Shechter holds of this, then you can't rely on what he quotes in the name of the Rav. You can't quote anything. So if you're interested in further, you can see in my book. David says, isn't there a major debate among Epstein Yaakov Nachum Epstein and other scholars that the version of Tosefta we have is the same version that the Stama had, and that perhaps it was edited, as Professor Elman writes in his PhD. I have to say, David Eisen, that I have no idea, and I do not know. Professor Elman, in his first book, which I don't know if anyone remembers because it was just for specialists. The other stuff is what everyone remembers, Yaakov Elman, who unfortunately also passed away, all about the Iranian stuff. I don't know. I really do not know the scholarship on the Tosefta with Epstein. But thank you for that. What was the Sri Yeshua's attitude to the question whether the editors of the Bavli and Tosefta and his approach in general to the academic study of Talmud? Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg writes that this is a kosher method, that you can interpret it different, and he does interpret, offers explanations to answer problems in the Gemara, problems for Talmudic sources, different than what the Gemara does. And he says it's okay, and he cites the Tosfos Yom Tov, who says it's okay, and he says the Rambam did it. The difference is it okay, and is it just an ad hoc thing? That's what Rabbi Weinberg did. When there's a real problem, occasionally you can do this. That's different than when you make a method out of it. If you look in Halivni, Makor to Masorot, page after page, that's all he does. So that's... Chaim says that he heard an online shiur by Rav David Weiss Halivni. He noted that the academic study of Talmud only had a place where the Rishonim had a problem with the sugya and could not agree on a resolution. But the thing is that in his writings, he will... I don't know what that means, cannot agree on a resolution. Halivni gives explanations that you don't find in the Rishonim. We have material the Rishonim didn't have. We have access to all sorts of material. There are plenty of examples, yes, where the Rishonim disagree. But he also, if you're interested in this, you can see the late, what's his name? Erwin Hout. His wife is Rivka Hout. He wrote a book, The Talmud as Law or Literature. And he picks maybe 10 different sugyas. And he shows you the traditional approaches to it and Halivni's approach to it. So you get a good sense of what Halivni was about. Mark asks, why was Mayim Achronim traditionally for men only? Women have to bench too. Are women? I don't know. I who says it was only for men? Today it is. But today it's only, we do it as a vestige. It's like nostalgia. But I know today it's only done for men. But who says it was in a, is there any reason to assume in the days of Gemara that it was only for men? No. The assumption is that it was for everyone. The question is today why they have to. I'm sure that you can find some Hasidic texts giving the reason, because the Hasidim are not doing it for Melech Sodomis. I don't know. It's a good question. David says the primary reason for Mayim Achronim is Halchana LeBerkos HaMazon seems to be the reason brought down by the Gemara. Yes. Okay. That's good. You're right. And Rabbi Rapport, as I recall, refers to that as well. So extrapolating to Rav Avraham and a Rambam, he sees that he doesn't, I was wrong with what I said. I said he just offers this as a reason. That's the reason. Thank you, David, which he cites. So the other reason is only the reason to keep people attached to it. Thank you. And David says, the reason the rabbis generally give for kitnios is likely not the main reason, that is making chametz-like products as opposed to finding wheat among corn and other legumes due to crop rotation. I don't know. I've never thought of it that way. I gave a whole class on kitnios. Are we saying the rabbis consciously are giving a false reason, David, or a reason they don't think is the real reason to keep people away? That would be the parallel to it. There definitely are examples of this, but I can't think of offhand. And finally, Chaim says, according to Dr. Brill, that's referring to Alan Brill, Rav Eliezer Henkin, you mean Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, permitted davening in a shul with mixed seating l'chadchila. Rav Moshe, on the other hand, termed it an isur d'areisa, possibly because of the danger he perceived in conservative Judaism. Okay, what Rabbi Henkin says is that, I don't know if you call this l'chadchila, he's speaking about, l'chadchila means you can go there. Rav Henkin, and this is different than Rav Moshe and the Rav. Rav Henkin, and we spoke about it in my classes on Rav Henkin, if you're in a town, for instance, and you're stuck there, and there's no shul other than a conservative, other than a non-machitza shul. When I say non-machitza, because a conservative shul today it could be in a different status because they're egalitarian today and they've changed the sitter. Remember what I told you, Rav Schechter permitted David Feldman's son, Daniel Feldman, to daven there because basically he said, just find a place where there's no women because that was the only issue. It was mixed seating. The sitter was the same. There's no egalitarian. So I don't know. So let's, instead of saying conservative, I'll say mixed seating, which is what you said. Rabbi Henkin said that he gave that as a possibility if you felt that you couldn't daven be yechidus. You can imagine someone, let's say you're stranded for a year in a place and you're not going to go to shul for a whole year. He thought that it could be permitted. You can find, in other words, you do when you find a place where there's no women. And he thought that that's, but it's not l'chadchila. It's the situation is what's the least worst? Is it have no connection to Kriyas HaTorah, have no connection to other Jews Shabbos morning? Or go into the conservative shul, and we're talking about an old-time conservative shul where it's not egalitarian, nothing like that, and just sit in a place where there's no women around. That's where he thought you could find a heter. So I don't call that l'chadchila. That I don't know what the Rav would have thought, said, because don't forget, the Rav publicly made these statements. You can't step foot even for to hear shofar. But privately, we know that he told rabbis to take positions in these shuls. And he also said that when he couldn't give permission to go into a non-machitza shul, he said to ask another rabbi. So he wasn't as strong. Justin says that German women didn't use mayim achronim due to the use of utensils. German and, I don't know what that means. German and women didn't use mayim achronim due to the use of utensils for eating. Do not have a ready source. Okay, that's another heter you can give. Baruch said exactly, context is key. For Finkin said such a thing, it was a long time ago. Conservative was much more traditional. Thank you all. This has been very, I'm glad to see you all again. I feel so many of you, it's been a year we've been together. And even you can make connections online. It's not the same thing, but I see you all in this this checkers box, you know, I see you all, but I see you, at least the ones that show me your faces. And I appreciate every week seeing you, and I hope you feel likewise. So with that, we say good night and call Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Just want to say we have a triple header tomorrow. Tomorrow is the 30th and last part of Benny Gesundheit's Shir on Tehillim. So if you want to try it out once, he's really quite a creative thinker. I think tomorrow is going to be a little bit different than the typical shearing, but being giving a 30-part shear, that's at 12:15. On the one side at 11 a.m., Ora Wiskin is going to be giving starting a five-part series, How the Baal Shem Tov Changed the World. Hasidic thought, that's sort of a very new subject for us. I think something very interesting. She's a real scholar in the field. And I invite everybody, that's at 11 a.m., followed by Dr. Tsunai, 12:15. And then at 1:30, Ilana Goldstein-Sachs is going to be giving a five-part series on Megillat Rut in the lead-up to Shavuot. So we actually have a triple header. I don't know if we're going to come to all three, sure, it'll break, but one or two is Kol HaMarbe HaReis Meshubach. And then we'll continue, as I mentioned earlier, I don't even have all the details yet, but Rav Shlomo Vilk from the Rav of the Beit Knesset Yael in Baca, many of you done there, interesting, and Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Machanaim will be giving a special shiur for Yom Ha'atzma'ut. That'll be on Thursday. We'll send out the details. And like we had this morning, we mentioned Ari Shvat started his seven-part series on religious Zionism. So we got lots doing. We've got 12 shiurim a week now, basically. So we've got lots to keep you busy, and pleasure to have you back, Dr. Mark, and we look forward to next week, and forward to seeing everybody. And I invite everybody, invite a friend, just invite one friend who hasn't experienced, you know, Torah and Moshe Zoom before, and let them come in, and that will be very nice. Okay, have a good night, everybody. Thank you, bye-bye.